Hi guys, I'm here with DeBen Davidson of Space Weather News and Suspicious Observers. He's got a YouTube channel and he's on a lot of other social media and he's amazing and he does a lot of, he tells you exactly what's happening with space weather and then what that could mean for our potential future cataclysm cycle, maybe, I would maybe say. That'll okay, work. So hi, welcome aboard, Ben.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so
I like your starry background.
Oh, you like this? Yeah, thank you. It kind of goes with your space weather. I recently have gotten into space weather a lot more seriously in terms of, like, I have the Space Weather Live app that always is, like, notifying me when there's, like, you know, a solar flare or this or that, which, by the way, January seems to have been like pop, 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 pop. So yeah, that was kind of fun. Okay, the first question I want to ask is, like, how reliable are all of our sources of the activity in space? Because I notice a lot of this, like, blackout or, like, radio blackout stuff where the data is, like, not showing up. Like, so how do you think about
that?
So
there are several redundancies, and unfortunately, there isn't really any one website that puts them all together on the same page. In terms of looking for solar flares, there are two satellites that NOAA uses, one that NASA uses, and there are actually other ways to look at that as well. In general, if you look at all the data sources, you can see that while some have different gaps here and there, it's simply because the satellite is orbiting the Earth, and sometimes it goes behind the Earth from the sun's perspective and actually gets eclipsed by our own planet. But that almost never happens to two satellites at the same time. Everything is pretty darn reliable. And when you have a solar telescope, especially one with an H alpha filter that lets you see the helium, which would be like the red fiery looking view that I show in my programs a lot of the times, you can pretty easily confirm that, yeah, okay, what you're getting on these feeds is what you actually see in the sky. When they tell you that the solar wind is intense and there's intense geomagnetic storms, there are dozens of aurora hunting groups that always post their photos to the internet. And so one expects there to be some pretty good ground-based civilian amateur photography corroboration of the geomagnetic side here on the Earth. I'd say that while nothing's perfect, it's gotten pretty darn robust, much more robust than it was about 20 years ago.
That's pretty cool. And then, so with the aurora borealis, which has also been really active lately, and so what do you, like, there's been some awesome pictures I've been seeing, like, on Twitter and stuff with us. I had mentioned in one of your videos that, you know, how there was, like, that pink aurora, like, earlier this year, and like, I also, like, on Twitter the other day, I was, like, seeing, like, rainbow aurorealises. And so, like, there's, like, a lot more color variation than there used to be, or supposedly. So this, you think, is indicative of our magnetic field weakening?
Absolutely. An excellent use of the word indicative. So those colors that we are seeing, we see them very rarely. And when we've seen them in the past, they only happen when we have a really, really big storm, like a once a decade solar storm. The problem is we're not getting anything even remotely close to that. Not only are they happening more often, but they're happening with weaker and weaker space weather, as we call it, weaker and weaker activity from the sun. And the reason why you get those colors is because it is about the depth of penetration of the charged particles from the sun and the abundance of them. Normally, the reason we don't see those and the reason why you only see them during the strongest geomagnetic storms is because Earth's magnetic field does a good job deflecting that, protecting our planet and atmosphere. Now that it is weakening and continuing to weaken, we are seeing more of that plasma, those charged particles able to penetrate and penetrate to deeper levels. And so we are seeing basically up at the top of the sky, the same kind of effects we normally see with a once a decade storm, except no such thing is taking place and they're happening more and more often. This is, of course, because the shield, our magnetic shield for the planet, is weakening.
So do you think that this has, okay, so it's weird because, you know, I also like watched some of your videos about how are you mentioned something about how the dude who built Coral Castle, what's his name again? Skeevy or
Ed Lee Scounin.
Ed Lee Scout. Yeah, I knew who he is, like, but I just he was talking about how, like, when the poles would flip, there would the moon would get closer, and it's almost like if this micronova. Okay, so like, let's okay, like, okay, so you're basically predicting that a micronova is going to happen, and it's going to be our next reset, and there's going to be a pole shift, and like, you don't exactly know the date or time, but sometime in our lifetime here, yeah. Coming up soon.
Correct.
Okay, so okay, cool, but I neither agree nor disagree. I think it's kind of that's where I'm kind of like, ooh, interested as well, but. It almost seems like it's this like working play. It's like our magnetic shield has to weaken in time for the moon to pull in, for the thing to hit at the exact, like, and it's almost like it's a predestined dance. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I would say so. And, you know, based on some of the stories of the very few civilizations that survived, whether these are passed down through Sanskrit texts, or we are doing our best to interpret rock art or cave art. Mm-hmm. It appears that these bad things all just kind of happen at once. And that's one of the reasons why we've come to believe that the trigger is from the galactic magnetic field, because that is one of the only things that can affect the entire solar system all at the same time.
So by that, you mean, instead of thinking about it, like, as if we're just rotating around the sun in like a little like diagram, we're actually like moving within the Milky Way, which is moving within something else. So it's something within the trigger of where we are and our placement within the Milky Way?
Sort of. We are moving through the Milky Way, but this is something that actually moves and comes to us. This is not, we moved into an area. This is the galactic magnetic fields of the galaxy are sweeping past us. So, Here's a good way to think about it. In 1 year, we make one orbit around the sun. During that 1 year, we're not perfectly flat on the sun's equator. We're slightly tilted. So we cross the equator once in the spring and then again in the fall. Mm-hmm. So we cross two times the sun's equator. But the equatorial rippling magnetic field of the sun hits us every 7 to 10 days because of how fast it ripples out and how much it's spinning. Same thing with the galaxy. It takes us about 250 million years to get all the way around the galaxy. It takes about 50 or 60 million years for us to do this up and down across the galactic equator. But the much faster moving magnetic field that is rippling outward, that comes by and sweeps past the solar system approximately every 12,000 years.
Okay, and that's like that whole like half of the Kali Yuga like cycle thing that
correct. I've heard a lot of people describe it with that. I've only looked into it in terms of seeing, oh, this is yet another group of individuals who have this general idea about cycles being very, very important for a number of reasons on the planet, and their timing happens to match up pretty darn good with what the physics and what other cultures have said. And what the geology says in terms of how often we get these major isotope changes coming down from space, things like that. Yes.
Definitely. Okay. So there's also, we got to talk about this real quick. Cause I look like, I live in Dallas right now. And, so, you know, a couple, like probably like 5-10 years ago, I got obsessed with Rockwall. And then that History Channel with that Scott Walter dude, I don't want to throw shade, but that was a bullshit episode.
That was ridiculous.
Like, I was like instant not a fan, and like, what? Like, that was the and you're the only other person I've heard like I got your book, and I was reading your book, and like when I got to the rock part, I was like, yes, thank you. Just the fact it's a natural wall, oh my god, that was just,
yeah. Nature doesn't build in squares and triangles. It doesn't put footholds in. It doesn't use plaster.
Or mortar. And
here's the thing. They didn't try to even address those things. They just went on highly flawed scientific methods outside
the magnetic filings of these three rocks that are right next to each other happen to be in the same alignment. oh, so therefore it's all natural. I was like, what? I guess, I don't know, or they just didn't want to deal with the significance of what that means to have a giant wall like that big in Texas.
I think that's very possible. A lot of times they will put out just enough information for people who can think for themselves to come to the right conclusion. But imagine if they actually told the world the truth about the Texas rock wall. It'd be chaos. The implications of that would destroy several aspects of our history, geology, even to a certain degree, some parts of religion. It would pretty quickly wake everybody up to the idea of what can actually happen on this planet and how devastating it could be. There's no more control. It's anarchy and chaos. And, you know, I know this. I wouldn't want to be the guy who had to decide whether or not we hide some elements of the truth or we just give all humans the truth. As much as, you know, my daily life is about trying to share that with as many people as possible. You know, if I got to the point where I was getting 30 million views a day, I'd have to really think about how I presented it. I wouldn't hide facts, but I would really have to spend probably half the time telling people, do not freak out.
Don't freak out. Yeah. So, but that's the other thing, though, I found my time on Earth here is that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And I mean, a lot of people are, they don't care. You know,
there's a lot of NPCs around the world today.
A lot of NPCs. In fact, it's majority NPCs, unfortunately. But yeah. Okay, so in that realm, let's go into how much do you think the quote unquote elite know?
Oh, all of it. All of it. Every last.
And we're just sort of picking up breadcrumbs like from deduction and just whatever and having to reverse engineer.
So I don't know how much you're going to want to get into this, but so I don't know if I believe that the things they believe in are real. So, for example, a lot of them are Satanists. I don't know if any of that stuff is real, but they sure believe it. And they have the money and the power to make aspects of it real. And I also know that part of the game is they have to respect their opponent and give their opponent a fair game. The game has to be, you know, they
I've heard that. It's kind of like you have to, it's almost like a vampire, right? Like you have to like get permission to be let in or something. You know, it's like you have to kind of show them what you're doing.
No, exactly. That's their karmic retribution thing. It's like, if I sell poison apples, you eat one and die, I've poisoned you and that's on me. But if I have a sign that says these apples are poison and you pick one up and you eat it anyway, that's not on me. That's on you. You killed yourself. That's not on me. That's their idea of karmic retribution. And there are a number of similar things that are like that, including in certain ways, respecting your enemy. If they don't lie, if they don't cheat, if they don't do certain things, which is why you see some people get tossed off social media. Other people don't get tossed off social media. Part of this is they have to let this information out to let us know what's going on so that it is a fair game.
See, but what I think a lot about is like, okay, let's say they can't even control the sun. Obviously they can't. Okay. But so they know this thing's coming. Why would you I sort of think there's like a slow depopulation agenda going on. I mean, like I'm in that camp, but, the thing is it's like, okay, if you're into that, but like, why would you want to look the Earth itself is like, if and when she changes and we can look at the fossil records and everything, we know that it's like pretty whoa. Why would you want to limit your diversification of genetic? I mean, it seems to me like you would want everybody to have their own chance because it's going to be a lot gone anyway, and then see what happens after that. It's very bizarre thinking on their part.
They are of the belief. They're of the belief that enough people are going to survive, that there will be enough diversity. They want there to be what they imagine is the correct number of people, not too few, not too many. Right now, they're worried there's going to be too many. They want to come out of this thing and get right back on top of the metaphorical pyramid of our species. They want to Tower have Babel control. Back. Exactly. They like being at the top of the pyramid. They like it, and they don't want their great grandchildren to be anything but at the top of the pyramid. I'm a parent. I get it. But still, there's a very narrow focused and very selfish aspect to that. But that's how it is. That is precisely what they are aiming for. They want, you know, they came to the conclusion that, okay, enough people are going to survive this, and maybe too many people, because you can't come out of your bunker or your, you know, come down from your spaceship or whatever to 10 million people sitting there waiting for you on the ground. Yeah. They're going to eat you worse, you know?
Right. And then our current power paradigms, like money and internet and everything like that's going to be gone. So it's going to be like, you know, dog eat dog kind of thing, I guess. And they're not as competitive in that realm.
They're hoping to have the right amount of resistance, which is just enough that they can't, that it can't actually overcome them.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's really interesting though. But okay, so let's veer into a lot of okay, so I have never really been a big fan of comet impacts. I think that they're like I'm into Robert Schoch's more like, and like what you kind of talk about, how like this vitrification, which is like the micro turning of glass and stuff. I do think that that's from something solar, or yeah, it's from something else, maybe super volcano, I don't really know. But like how do you justify or talk or think about like tektites and all the like microspheroids and stuff like that, and the vitrification that we have?
And I'll start by remembering it was 2014 when I did a fantastic interview with Robert Schoch.
Yeah, it was very good. I liked it.
It was so fantastic that I cut out the best parts and I put it in the latest version of the disaster movie, the thing that tries to piece everything all together. He and I have been on the same page now for pretty much a decade. I think Robert Schoch has as much figured out as probably any of the rest of us catastrophists do. The interesting thing about having a solar micronova produce this is it's the only thing that can explain all the evidence. And that includes the evidence of a cycle of impactors. When the sun blasts off its outer shell, that's going to cool, congeal in space. Those are impactors. It's going to blow asteroids out of their path. Those could be impactors. The problem is you can't explain some of the isotopes. You can't explain super lightning. You can't explain the microtektites, which are the tiny little glass spherules. Now, there are microtektites on this planet that are from things like volcanoes, that are from things like impactors.
Yeah, exactly.
But those all have little gas bubbles inside of them. The class of microspherules that does not have glass bubbles in them, but instead are peppered with high isotope cosmic rays, fission tracks, they called them, and no gas bubbles inside. You can't have that happen on the Earth. That can't happen on our planet. And so when you realize that a micronova nova level event on the sun is going to be producing a lot of oxygen, a lot of silicon, along with other things, you know, silicon dioxide is sand, is glass. This is how you actually get that class of microtektites, in addition to all the other high isotope cosmic ray fission tracks that you see in everything from petrified wood from those days, the bones of animals in the surge deposits, and of course those microtektites. And so it's interesting because there's enough evidence of there being impactors for those impactor theorists to get behind it and push and push and push. But about 150 years ago, I want to say, one of the greatest catastrophists, his name was Hibben, he put forth the challenge: any catastrophist worth his salt must explain all the evidence. And when it comes to these cycles, yes, there's impactors, but there's also those nova level isotopes and the microspherules, the tektites that don't have gas bubbles. The fact that Earth's magnetic field shifts every single time, the fact that there's a global outbreak in volcanoes, And the only way you can explain all of those things is through a massive electromagnetic insult from the sun. Mm. Excuse my turn of phrase.
Well, and especially the amount of ground it covers, you know. It's like 30% like you could tell was like, boom, like hit. Then that's like, that's not an asteroid. That's
correct.
Okay, so then, like, how much crustal displacement do you think, like, goes on during all these kinds of times? I mean, and, like, what's your kind of thing? Okay, because, okay, that's the question, but let me just, like, tell you some thinking here. So, like, I'm a big fossil hunter. There's ginkgo leaves that are bigger than my body, okay? Like, there's things that... the megafauna itself was way bigger. I think the conditions of Earth have been different in past times, like meaning maybe time passed differently. Maybe our magnetic gouge was differently. Maybe gravity worked differently. Like the physics of the Earth had to work differently for the size and the scale of the things that are going. Okay, great. Like, do you think that maybe we could get pushed out further or pulled in closer, or could the way in which we, you know, experience time change?
I think that two of the better, the time change one is interesting. I'm going to spend some time thinking about that later. I haven't thought about that one. The best explanations for how big things were in the past are, one, they were more aquatic than we realized. Big things can survive much easier in water. And two, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the Earth breathes. It gets bigger, it gets smaller. It gets bigger, it gets smaller. We have been in an expanding phase, which is why there's all those expanding Earth theories. There's much of that that is absolutely true. It's just that if you keep looking back and back in time, it looks like it's actually been doing this in the cycle, which also really helps explain those things.
Well, that actually, for me, I kind of got the impression you weren't a Charles Hapgood fan, but
fan.
But he did have the expanding and contracting Earth.
Oh yeah, theory. A lot of people do that. And you know, just because I disagree with someone's theory, I mean, there's almost nobody who has dedicated a significant amount of their life to this who I don't find something of merit
in their work. The tectonic plate theories don't always 100%. I was a geology major for like 3 years, and like I'm very interested in that stuff, and it didn't always make sense to me. I do feel like you do have an expansion and contraction. It looks like they. I don't know. I get that. I don't understand how it would. If you take like myth theories or something, it's like the rains came down and the waters came up. It's like, where did the water come up from too? Not just tsunami. I mean, I almost feel like our inner oceans at some point when we contract, maybe.
Oh, there's three times the amount of water
underneath us
in the mantle than there is in the entire oceans on top of the world. Three times as much in the mantle. And you know, that's not even counting what's inside the crust. So good. You seem to have a pretty good wide field of knowledge here. But getting back to your question about the crustal shift, it wasn't until about three years ago or so where I knew the crust shifted based on the evidence. I had looked at, you know, everything from the ancient stories to even Einstein said that it happened. Pretty much every catastrophist ever said that that's what happened. But I still, up until a couple years ago, had questions about exactly how much it shifts. Is it, you know, 180 degrees? Is it 90 degrees? Is it Charles Hapgood's just a couple of degrees and then a couple of degrees? And then found Major White's stuff that he gave to his son, Ken White, to publish in the book World in Peril. The short version of the story is one of the most important military missions of the last century was Project Nanook, which was sent to the Arctic. The stated purpose of this was to go up to the Arctic, learn how to navigate in the Arctic Circle, where, you know, you don't just have the magnetic North Pole for navigation in one direction the entire flight. You know, you start the flight and it's ahead of you, but halfway, nope, now it's behind you. How do you navigate now? And then also to set up stations to watch for Russia coming over the top, because in the 1940s, that was a major concern. But when they were actually going and seeking out the magnetic pole, they were noticing, hey, wait a minute, we have evidence of it here and then evidence of it over there and evidence of it appears to be moving. And so they started digging and doing a lot of other studies around there. They brought tons of geologists up there to actually join the military mission. It very quickly became a joint military science mission, whereas it started pretty much as just a military mission. Mm-hmm. What those geologists found was that once they dug down past the ice, they found 12,000 year layers, one on top of another, and they alternated polar fossils, tropical fossils, polar fossils, tropical fossils, polar fossils. And the only way to do that is if you get that part of the world to the equator and then back again, that part of the world to the equator and back again. And they included the math from the RAND Corporation, who even to this day does a lot of secret stuff for the government. They did the math to verify, okay, this is how this would work with the magnetic field. And again, this is all by a book, Ken White, called World in Peril. The reason we have this information is because Major White, upon the classification of these documents, he said, no, he kept a bunch of them. He kept a bunch of the documents from the Pentagon meetings, and he kept a bunch of the documents from the RAND Corporation's analysis to give to his son decades later so that his son could publish this stuff in a book for all of us. That was his like dying goal. And thank goodness he did. Otherwise, we might still not have any idea that it was a 90-degree flip and flip back. Now, in addition to them, the fossil layers, that's one piece of evidence. The math that the RAND Corporation did and the conclusions of the Pentagon, number two. We take a look at exactly what it would take to do this. And we realize, wait a minute, that actually is the only option. So here's number three. The only way you're going to get a shift over is if you can unlock the crust from the mantle. Now, when you think about it, in reality, why don't the crust bang about at, you know, with the fault lines? Why don't they break around? Because there's this friction, this thermodynamic equilibrium right there. And it's actually electrodynamic as well, where the combination of the electrostatic forces and the thermal condition of the mantle crust boundary really make it stick together, like putting a piece of Saran wrap down and then another one on top. You could peel it off, but what if you grab the side and tried to pull it off? You're not going to do it. They're going to stick together,
right?
Even though there's no glue in there, there's no nothing. It's just, it's a completely different kind of sticking.
Yeah.
The problem is, when you get a major induction from a solar event, even the modern day ones, which aren't so powerful, they can tell that that induces electric current all the way into the mantle. Now, what happens when you have the Titanic version of that? You're going to get a phenomenal electric current at the low velocity zone, which is what they call the boundary between the mantle and the crust. That huge amount of electric current, huge amount of Joule heating is going to change the electrostatic conditions and the thermal conditions there. And all of a sudden the crust is unlocked and is free to spin. So how does it spin? Well, as with any spinning object, any uneven weight distribution. So like, let's say you have a perfect ball sphere and you spin it like this. If there's like a tiny little bit too much weight up on one area, the greatest weight wants to spin at the point of greatest centrifugal force. This is basic physics. Mm-hmm. And where that is that is the ice that is accumulated at the polar regions. Because after, you know, after the crust shifts and then it resettles, everything's not perfectly homogeneous, but it resettles into a balance. And then the ice starts accumulating at the polar regions. So no matter what, when this happens after 12,000 years of new ice coming to the polar regions, that's what's going to want to be at the equator. And the only way to do that is a 90-degree flip.
And so now, that's why it doesn't last long, right? Because once that melts, it goes boom back.
It'll stay like that for probably 12,000 years.
Okay, so the 90-degree turn, because I was thinking that they rebounded back pretty quickly, but they don't. Like you're saying that they'll kind of...
Correct. Well, because don't forget, the fossil layers were 12,000 years apart. Each one is... like that.
Is there a way to know kind of like where former poles have been? Like, what's the methodology to kind of figure that out?
So they know where some of them have been. It's kind of hard because right now the area where the poles are going to be next time, and we can actually tell because we know where the ice weight distribution is at the north and the south. Those areas are underneath the bottom of the ocean where nobody's ever done corings. Like people don't go down 2,000 feet and then right. try to drill 1,000 feet into the ground. I mean, you study geology, you know this. Yes. They'll do that with ice from the surface. They'll do that while they're on land, but nobody goes to the bottom of the ocean to drill corings like that. Or else they'd be able to find a lot more evidence of this. And so I know that was a long way to get to number three, but we basically have the alternating layers, the math from the Pentagon and the RAND Corporation, and then the basic physics of, okay, if you can unlock the crust, you can with a major solar event. What happens to that extra weight? It wants to go exactly here, which is corroborating the 90 degree shift. And so those three things all together really tell us it is a 90 degree shift.
Well, and then there now is it Milankovitch right. cycles, or what is the one where it's like the iron filings?
I don't really know exactly how much I believe exactly what to think about these Milankovitch cycles. I've studied them, but there are alternative explanations other than the Earth getting slightly further away and slightly closer to the sun. I like to reserve judgment on that one.
Okay.
But do you know a question I get a lot about the Earth turning like this, 90 degrees? People are like, okay, well, why do they say that there's been ice at the poles for millions and millions of years? And there's two things with that. A lot of their isotope dating that they use for these things has some problems.
Yeah.
Carbon dating, most of all.
Carbon dating has horrible problems, yeah. Like you can take
In addition to the fact that you can't really trust their dating when they say things are millions of years old, think about the fact that we still have tropical glaciers today. We have tropical glaciers today, and this is an interglacial cycle. The Holocene, the last 12,000 years, hotter than it's been in 100,000 years. You know, all the previous 12,000 year cycles going back, you know, 7, 8, 9 of them, those were all in a glacial cycle. If we've still got tropical glaciers right now, after 12,000 years of an interglacial, you can move Greenland and Antarctica to the equator. They're not going to melt. Not in a glacial cycle. I mean,
especially if enough of it gets covered with some sort of sediment, that can be an insulator. Absolutely. That is, you know, fine.
There should also be a phenomenal amount of fog at the equator for quite some time. There will be a time when, after this happens, as there is starting to be a bit of a melt from the ice that has gone to the poles. I mean, have you ever seen icebergs calving? The amount of fog and mist is unbelievable. That happens anytime you're melting ice and putting it into the ocean. There should be like a ring of fog around the equator such that low mid latitudes may actually be more sun exposed, maybe even hotter than the equator. That last one's a question because we don't know what kind of insulative impact all of that extra water vapor would have. But that will also act as an albedo effect and help keep that ice from freezing for quite some time. And again, because it will be a glacial cycle and not an interglacial, no, there's no way those will melt off if we still have tropical glaciers today. And again, you only need to get to that argument if you are dead set on believing the isotope dating. So,
yeah, that's true. Which I'm a big megalith like person, and you know, just like trying to see the flaws in the dating of stone.
I like you.
Thanks. Like, yeah, I'm my channel is called Nikiana Jones because like I go to all these like megalithic places and stuff like that, and I really am interested in that. But the dating on it is just it's kind of comical. I mean, and they'll find like a they found a hearth, or you know, they find some sort of fire that someone set up one time, and then that the site's only 1,000 years old, and you're going, okay. So I'm totally down with the whole, like, I just throw the dating out at this point. I don't even care what they say it is. Yeah. Okay. So earthquake predictions and like the volcanic stuff based on the sun's activity, how accurate is that? And what I've noticed you do a lot of, you have some stuff with this.
It depends whether you want to know more about, you know, your day-to-day earthquake forecasting or what is going to happen in the big event. You know, in the big event, when the crust unlocks, we're talking about a global earthquake. I mean, the great earthquake, which will also be a great volcanic uprising pretty much everywhere across the world. That's not going to be fun. That's not going to be fun at all. But were you asking about the more day-to-day stuff?
Yeah, just like how accurate is like the sun's activity to correlate with actual?
So the higher magnitude you get, the more correlated it is. When you're talking about magnitude 5, magnitude 6, there is enough of a statistical correlation with the sun's activity to say, okay, this is way more than one would expect from a randomized distribution. Yes, we know there are solar flares here and there. Yes, we know there are earthquakes here and there. Based on how many there are of these and how many are there of these, how many should just by accident appear to be correlated? And it's about 150 to 200%. And that's enough to easily be called statistically significant. When you get up to the magnitude 8 and higher, we're talking about 1,000% more than would be expected from randomized distribution. Wow. To the point where specifically with the solar polar magnetic fields, which have the ability to affect Earth all the way down to the core. I mean, they're so powerful, they stream out past Pluto. We notice when the solar polar magnetic fields are at their peaks or they're reversing north to south, positive to negative, et cetera, it's one of those all thumbs are fingers, but not all fingers are thumbs thing. It's very, I mean, 9 out of 10 magnitude 8 earthquakes happen during one of those periods when we are at peak magnetic force or a magnetic reversal of the solar polar fields. And, you know, we're talking about significant events that happen over a couple of days, a couple times a year. So, you know, we're talking about maybe 3 to 6% of the days in the year, but like 80, 90% of the biggest earthquakes happen during those times. That's not a coincidence right there. Because if it was,
super volcanoes are kind of scary to me too. And I wonder about, that's gonna be fun.
There are statistically significant correlations with the volcanic activity as well. Not quite as high as they are with the earthquakes. What really scares me about this is there are more papers about cosmic ray impacts on volcanoes, because the cosmic rays, the highest energy ones can go right through the Earth and never hit a thing. But the ones that are just below that, they tend to be absorbed in silica-rich magma. Silica-rich magma volcanoes are the ones that explode. Mm-hmm. Those are the scary ones. And one of the main things about losing Earth's magnetic field, remember, it's weakening. We're getting bombarded with more and more cosmic rays, and those have a better and better chance of actually triggering those major volcanic eruptions. So it's a significant major concern for this event, no doubt about it. The two super volcanoes I'm most worried about are Campi Phlegrei in Italy and Taupo in New Zealand. Those are just horrifying to think about going off in the modern age. I would be horrified about Yellowstone, but it shows all evidence that it's broken right now.
But there's other giant calderas, like in New Mexico or Colorado. So it's like, I don't know.
So to be clear, I think that Yellowstone, Valles Caldera in northern New Mexico, which is gorgeous to drive through, even if it takes forever.
It does.
Seriously, driving from Albuquerque to Colorado is like unbelievably mind-bending. But you know, I think that most of those volcanoes will have at least effusive eruptions, which is kind of like what Hawaii does. It bubbles up and it pours out. But you know, Hawaii doesn't explode like that. And so that's the difference between an effusive eruption and an explosive eruption. I think that Yellowstone and Valles Caldera will probably both have effusive eruptions during this event. I don't know as much about Valles Caldera, but I think that there's evidence to suggest that Yellowstone is currently broken in terms of being able to create an explosive volcanic event. Maybe that won't be the case next cycle, but for now, every time it gets pressure building up, we see quakes and geysers and geothermal heat release. Doesn't seem to be able to hold that pressure in, which is really what you need to get that explosive eruption.
And now this like lopsided core of the Earth, do you think like when does that end up like shifting inside as well too and changing? Do you think?
I think there's a good possibility of that. Both the lopsided core and what they call the large low shear velocity provinces completely destroyed this idea of this homogeneous shell within a shell Earth.
Right.
Which is what many folks say is like, oh, Earth can't tilt, Earth can't do this. It's perfectly symmetrical about the second axis up and down. But it's like, no, actually, it's really, really not.
Being a big fossil digger, like, you know, I there's so many, this is one thing that kind of makes me go, like, oh, but like, I go to construction sites all over like Dallas or whatever. And like, I'll just like on the weekends when no one's working and I'll just like, you can find like all kinds of ammonites or bifocal clams or like brachiopods or whatever, but I can get like a square inch rock or like a foot by foot rock and it'll just be teeming with life. So it'll have like 1,000 shells in it. And I'm going, we don't have a square foot by square foot place on this planet right now that if it just flash froze, there'd be 1,000 of any life form in it, you know, like into this level. There was a time where I think we had way more life than we currently have. Yeah. So it's kind of like, that can be a little shocking for me at sometimes, but okay. So speaking of life, I think the thing that I get, that people ask you the most of what I watch is, will this area be okay? Will this one be okay? Like, you need some interactive map of Ben's predictions of where you're fucked or not. You know, it's like, that's super, it's kind of funny to watch because that's about like 90% of your questions I see on things. It's like, what about this place or this place? How do you deal with all that? And how do you research what you think is going to fare well in which places?
So there's a couple key things to remember. I've been doing a lot more to try to help visualize where the water is going to go when the crust shifts. But outside of that, the two things that I keep telling people over and over again are, think about your weather right now at the peak of summer and the peak of winter. Can you survive those without electricity, whether that's air conditioning in the summer or heat in the winter? Do you know what to do? I'm not saying it's impossible. There's a lot of people that pull it off. But if you don't think you could survive your winters with no electricity, you're not in a good space. If you are anywhere near a big city, you are not in a good space, because there will be absolute chaos in the big cities when this occurs. Other than that, it's largely about
elevation.
Largely about elevation and distance from a coastline. And if possible, having something underground, whether that's an extremely robust basement, my least favorite, a root cellar, something like a bunker, caves, mines nearby, something that'll help get you underground in case you need it. Because in the immediate aftermath, while there will be some pretty heightened radiation levels, they're not so high that they're just going to kill everybody, because otherwise there wouldn't be any animals left on the planet today. Mm-hmm. But in localized areas, the hail, the wind, the lightning, and the extreme cold are going to be pretty extreme. It's going to be very useful to have a place to go hide and let the Earth itself protect you. Very useful. We see that in most of the cultures that survived the last one. Either that, or they went and hid inside the stone megaliths, which would be about the only thing you could make that would survive this.
I think Dallas is pretty screwed. I'm gonna have to move pretty soon. It's not gonna really work for me. I know stuff is changing though, because it's like sprites. Okay. I remember learning about like those light, they're like, the lightnings that go up in the atmosphere, and they're like these red like lightning things, and I remember hearing about those for the first time, I don't know, maybe like 10 or 15 years ago, and it was like only two have ever been caught on camera. And then now I see people that catch them all the time. Like there's so many pictures of them online, and I'm going, they weren't even a phenomenon, and now they're just like everywhere.
They want us to believe that cameras have all of a sudden gotten so much.
That's what
better.
They say.
That's what they want us to believe. No, absolutely not. People have been looking for sky phenomena forever. People have been photographing lightning at slow-mo speed forever. Mm-hmm. One of the things we need to expect is more powerful, more frequent lightning. Almost every lightning record has fallen multiple times in the last decade. And the other thing is you can easily just look this up on the internet. Just type in cosmic rays, lightning. They don't even hide that in the peer-reviewed science journals. They know cosmic rays trigger lightning. And so since cosmic rays are on the up and up as we're losing Earth's magnetic field, that's another thing to be expecting. More lightning, an over-electrified atmosphere.
So then okay, so you kind of think there's indicators before like a completely screwed event. What's kind of like, what can you walk us through real quick, like exactly how you think this is going to shake down for those who've never heard of you or anything?
Sure. We'll start with the caveat. It appears that the people in charge of this planet don't care about us at all. And they actually want to throw us into more disarray and chaos as we're going through this. And so always keep in mind that they could do something 10 times as disruptive as COVID. And all of a sudden, you're prepping, your time to get ready is just over. Other than that, at some point in the next decade or so, the Earth's magnetic field will get so weak that almost anything from the sun is going to take out global power. At that point, where you are is where you are. There's no more going to the store to get anything. Yeah, okay, the radiation and the waves aren't coming yet. But basically, the world goes back to the Bronze Age, if not the Stone Age, right away. And at some point around, and you know, and while this is happening, the lightning will be getting worse, the weather will be getting more extreme. If in your area you've noticed that it's been way hotter than normal, and then a terrible storm rolls through, and then a couple of days later you're like, wait a minute, now it's 15 degrees colder than normal. Weather usually goes like this, but now it's more extreme swings, and that's going to get more extreme as well. More extreme lightning, more extreme hail, floods and droughts in areas that aren't used to floods and droughts, or floods and droughts that are more extreme in places that are used to seeing floods and droughts. Everything will be getting an extremification until sometime in the 2030s and 2040s, when the sun starts to really change its look in the sky. When that happens, you've just got days remaining until all the big bad stuff happens. That would mean that the actual rippling galactic waves we were talking about before, they have hit the center point of that wave, and north has become south, or south has become north, and the galactic magnetic reversal is happening. That not only is going to have an electrical change to the sun's surface activity, which will affect its photoluminescence, its light production, and it will start to change that way. But that's like the Swiffer static duster in space carrying all the dust. And so while the sun is being electrically disrupted, dust is going to be dumped onto the sun. And so this dual aspect is going to change the way the sun looks, probably shifting from red to maybe even dark, looking almost black. But just as quickly as that onsets, the other magnetism is coming behind it. The sun kicks back into gear and realizes somebody threw a blanket over its head, and it blasts off this new shell of material. In a resurgent flash, which we call the solar micronova, which is, of course, where we get the microtectites, the glass spherules, we get the nova-level isotopes, we get the impactors as well from the shell and it pushing asteroids out of their current path. That's the blast that's going to unlock the crust. And so while the impact, while, you know, the impactors and the microtectites are falling, and while we're at the peak levels of radiation, that's when the Earth starts to do this. And this is all going to happen over the span of just, you know, the Earth, the sun changing color will be just a couple days. But when the micronova actually happens on that flash, one day we get stuff coming down. The Earth starts to go like this. The tsunamis race over the continents. It is a one-day cosmic Super Bowl. And if you survive it, good for you.
You're good. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that paints quite the picture, Ben. It really does. Wow. Okay. Well, real quick. The Carrington event, do you think, like, what level of what was that like in terms of, like, we don't really know because we weren't measuring things the same way now, but do you think that was just a solar flare, or do you think that was like a micronova, or like, what do you think was?
No, I think that was probably an X40 or an X50 solar flare.
Okay. That just hit us.
Well, one of the things to know is the micronova will happen during a sunspot minimum, almost certainly. Wow. Sunspots are going to help clear away that dust. It really is like the depression and the lower activity of the sun that lessens its light and that allows the dust to actually accumulate rather than being blown away by the solar wind. So yes, the drawings of the sunspot that day by Richard Carrington are phenomenal. I don't know if you've ever seen those, but that was almost certainly like an X40 or an X50 solar flare. They actually could see the flare in the white light spectrum. These days, most of the solar flares, you need either the X-ray or the ultraviolet spectrum to actually see it. I mean, even if you're looking at the sunspots through a telescope, when there's a flare, you don't see a white flash in almost every case. But apparently they actually saw a white light flare associated with that event. That was something that hasn't happened to that degree since then.
Yeah. And so, you know, I kind of wonder if, like, we have a lot of those intermittently spread out throughout, you know, the cycles, you know. And
oh, yeah. Something like that probably happens every 150 to 200 years. It's just that we've never had an electrified society that had to worry about it before.
Right.
You know, something like the Carrington event, as Titanic as it was, that's not an extinction level event for the planet. Yeah, it probably
affected weather, but like not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We know there are even bigger solar events on even longer cycles, millennial, 3,000 years, 6,000 years. It's interesting that mainstream science has now come around to calling these, you know, millennial cycles. There's a 3,000 year flare, an even bigger 6,000 year flare. We'll just scale that up one more to 12,000 years, and we're at the disaster cycle, and it's a full micronova. It's kind of amazing. Every hole in the story has been plugged over the last couple of years to where it now paints a full puzzle picture. I can't
except
be
like the Earth standing still thing, like that. That one's kind of our, you know, the you know, like the legends of like, oh, we didn't have a day for this long or that. Or
so here's the thing: if you take the globe and you tilt it 90 degrees, the areas right here don't actually change latitude; they just spin.
Okay.
And so if you had an area that was getting ready to turn into the sunlight, but the Earth tilts in such a way that it's like the sun would be getting ready to rise, and then because of the 90 degrees, it's going to go back down. And for some places in the world, it's going to seem like the sky is standing still and turning. You could get a long night. And so, yes, there are ways to get some of those ancient stories if the Earth stops. But you can also get it in certain parts of the world just from the 90 degree turn. Which is why those stories are far less common than, in general, the stories of catastrophe.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I always think about the Aborigines, like, talk about how, like, they replaced the sun, like there was a different sun, or even like a South American cultures. And it's like the time that we're in the age of the fifth sun or age of the, you know, I mean, they have like these things. I mean, I definitely think there's the reason we have so much crazy petroglyphs and stuff about, I mean, there's something happens with the sun, like, for sure. Like, we are not on a fixed, like, thing that doesn't change. We are just happened to have been born into a time where we haven't had a lot of change yet. But so,
I agree.
And even if this doesn't happen, like, in this next cycle, it's going to happen eventually. We're due. So, you know, I think this is like, it's just good to be aware of. And, you know,
well, you know, in addition to that, take a look at what's going on.
Yeah.
You've got everything from people like Kim Kardashian getting in trouble for building a bunker at her home in LA. The number of multi-million dollar bunkers being sold is up like 50,000%. Elon Musk.
Yeah.
He's preparing to be able to go up or down with his boring company. Yeah.
Same thing with Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos, his new origins, Blue Origin launch facility is across the street from the mountain he's hollowing out. A ton of elites are doing this. The governments are acting reckless because they know there's not going to be a reckoning. They are spending like there's no tomorrow because they know soon there won't be. And they're doing everything they can to put themselves in the best position to resource grab and to keep everyone distracted so that we don't cause chaos and anarchy and end their ability to actually resource grab and do these other things. And even the elites that are on our side, there are white hats who fancy themselves as Batman or have messianic complexes or who believe in a different kind of karma and want to save everyone. They won't be able to execute those plans if the world is in chaos. They need the world turning and, you know, infrastructure moving in order to be able to execute any of this. So both the white hats and the black hats both want this hush hush for now. And
They know what's happening.
And they're acting like it's going to happen soon. They're definitely acting like it's going to happen soon.
I definitely came about, I came through this, not through space weather, but I came through this from, look, you know, like I, like when I went, like, it's a megalithic thing for me where I'm going, like, we did not build these in the same, like, I'm not saying that humans didn't build them. Okay. But I'm saying that our current technology that we have did not, like, they had advanced technology. Like, where is this technology? Yeah. Like, something happened to these people and they were on par with us in another kind of intelligence way, or, you know, they there was an advanced globalized civilization before they're telling us there was. Mm-hmm. And it's, if you study enough megaliths, you 100% like cannot deny it.
I would agree with that. And I even add on to that by saying there's all the evidence to believe that the last civilization technologically got beyond where we are now. And there's no evidence, like they went back to zero. They went back to zero. So what do you think is going to happen to us when this happens? It's going to be rough. It's something that everybody needs to prepare for in a big way.
I agree. I totally agree. Well, thank you so much, Ben. This has been awesome. So tell everybody how they can, I mean, you do a video like two times a day or something. It's amazing.
Right. You know, we have 1,000 different things that we do in 1,000 different places on the internet, but the nexus of all of it, and it's free, is the Suspicious Observers YouTube channel on YouTube. So come watch our free content and keep an eye on everything that's happening there.
And it's, and you always say, no fear, eyes open.
Yeah, eyes open, no fear.
I love that. It's so perfect for exactly what you're talking and telling us all. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Pleasure being here. Thank you. Bye. Ha ha ha.